thanks. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about contextual interactions and normalizing nonlinearities in visual cortex. And I'll tell you about the beginning. I'll tell you about some published experimental work we did together with David Furster's lab. Hirofumi Ozaki was the first author on that. The earlier work, the published work I'm going to tell you about, was done by Brendan Murphy, and Evan Schaefer helped on this as a rotation student. And then the later stuff I'm going to tell you about is especially done by Dan Rubin and also Jun Zhao, and they're just wonderfully talented grad students. I'm very lucky. So, okay. How many people don't know basic visual cortexology? Anybody? Okay, so I'm going to run through this. V1, orientation to receptive fields, retinotopic map. Map of orientation preference. Is there anything unfamiliar to anybody? Stop me. Long-range connections, which are orientation-tuned. Long-range excitatory connections, which are orientation-tuned. This is what contrast is. Okay. Everybody with me? Good. Okay. So, thoughts on just some background as to, you know, some context for what this is all about. What are at least some of the things the cortex has to do? Our sense data arrives locally. We get punctate somatosensory stimuli. We see locally. We get local and visual stimuli. We get local and frequency auditory stimuli. Perception involves knitting this together globally into objects, and objects, amazingly, you know, have this property of persisting across the variation of the local data and yet being dependent upon the local data. So, localized contours, punctate somatosensory stimuli. Yet, you know, you're not feeling that. You're feeling your chair and your clothes. Auditory stimuli are, you know, come in locally in frequency, but you hear auditory streams, which are all across the frequency band. And similarly, on the motor side, there's this movement between the high level and the low level. We experience high level motor plans, like, you know, I'm going to pick up my pointer. And those can be implemented in many ways. They're invariant too, and yet they're dependent on the details, just as with sensory objects. So how are objects knit together? Well, you know, that's the big question, but at least it seems like a plausible picture is that there are long-range contextual interactions within one cortical area that are beginning to do some knitting together. And then there is hierarchical feed-forward and feedback between the areas, with larger invariant structures emerging gradually as you move up, but just talking back with the lower level structure. So for example, so the small steps per movement across areas, for example, V2, but not V1, puts together these two lines and sees an illusory contour between them. So how do contextual and top-down influences modulate responses? Well, and this could be a whole talk, but it won't be. But I'm just going to assert that the response selectivity of neurons for orientation, position, et cetera, is very much created by the arrangement of the feed-forward inputs into the cells in the input recipient layer in layer 4. And anybody who's interested, I can point you to a whole body of work on that, including some of my modeling and a whole lot of experimental work. But let's just take that as a given. What context or attention or various forms of modulation appear to do primarily, there may be some effect on selectivity, but it's not big. The major thing is they appear to modulate the gain of the response. And so what I'm going to be talking about today are just some very broad circuit motif explorations of mechanisms of contextual modulation, gain modulation, interaction between stimuli, so-called normalization, which David Heeger has brought to everyone's attention for a long time now, and also of the nonlinear dependence of these properties on the network activity level, or when network activity level is driven by a visual stimulus, on the stimulus contrast. These are going to be very simple models. I'm going to ignore cortex's 6 layers and blah, blah, blah. I'm just going to think about one layer. Imagine that we are modeling interactions within layer 2, 3, a layer which does have nice long-range interactions. I'm going to consider that there's two types of neurons, excitatory and inhibitory. We know there's lots of subtypes. They have different properties. That's, you know, next step. Today, we have excitatory and inhibitory neurons. And the essential idea that I'm going to try to get across to you today is that response suppression by context, a surround can suppress a response to a center. One stimulus might suppress a response to another. The assumption has been that this arises from activation of some set of inhibitory neurons, which fire more. They're not suppressed, but they in turn then suppress the other neurons. I'm going to present a different picture. Furthermore, some forms of this suppression only appear at higher contrast. And thus far, this has generally been interpreted in terms of that there must be some hidden class of inhibitory neurons that have high thresholds. So they're just not very active at low contrast, and then they kick in at high contrast and start suppressing things. Now, nobody's ever seen these neurons, these inhibitory neurons, and I'm going to show you some evidence that, at least in some paradigms, that they're not there. And what I'm going to hope to show you is that all of this can result from a very simple, very generic network dynamics in which the entire network, both the E and the I cells, move together. They undergo the suppression or a loss of amplification together, and that that's what's underlying these phenomena. And furthermore, as I'm going to show you at the end, and that's sort of the coolest stuff, so stick around if you can, an expansive input-output cellular nonlinearity, which doesn't have to, you know, be a higher power for the I cells. It can be identical for the I cells. It automatically leads to this contrast dependence, to these two regimes. There's a low contrast regime in which things facilitate, add superlinearly, and a high contrast regime where they add sublinearly and then suppress. And it just pops out very generically from the fact that you have this expansive nonlinearity.
What do you mean by expansive?
The input-output function has a positive second derivative. Okay, so we're going to start with surround suppression. We're going to start with published work because that's what it's built on. And just reminding everybody, the classical receptor field is the region in which appropriate visual stimuli elicit spikes. The extraclassical receptor field is the surround. Visual stimuli don't elicit spikes, but they can modulate the responses to center stimuli. And so this is showing from the Chinese visual cortical physiology group, Song and Li, that they define the classical receptor field by bringing in a stimulus and seeing where it was centered on the receptor field of the cell and seeing where the cell first starts to respond. And when you define it that way, this is called the minimal response field. That is the region where you can actually drive spikes. The size of the receptor field is the same at all contrasts, they showed. Although the surround doesn't drive spikes, it can modulate spiking responses. And so surround suppression is very ubiquitous in V1 and in other pieces of cortex in different forms. And here's an illustration from David Furster's lab. And so here's just a stimulus restricted to the classical receptor field. The idea this is drifting periodically, and this is the over one cycle. This is the histogram of spikes that are elicited. So you get a nice robust response. You make it bigger, the response is smaller. This is an orientation tune suppression. So if the surround is the opposite orientation of the center, there's very little suppression. But if it's the same, there's a very strong suppression. And about half of the V1 cells in layers 2 to 4 show, you know, statistically significant suppression by the surround. So what's the likely mechanism of the surround suppression? Well, again, what everyone has thought, the surround stimulus presumably stimulates surrounding regions of cortex. So if here's the piece of cortex corresponding to the center, these two piece areas only communicate with each other by the long-range excitatory connections. And of course, maybe by some chains, but at any rate, think about they're far enough apart that the only direct communication is by long-range excitatory connections. And to cause suppression, well, then this excitation coming into the local circuit must be driving inhibitory cells, and the idea then is that they're going up and they're firing, they're not surround suppressed, and they're then pushing everyone else down. And so the prediction of that picture is that if you record intracellularly from cells and look at what happens when they're being surround suppressed, that you should see the inhibition they receive goes up, and that's what's causing the suppression. David?
I'm stuck on that first premise.
Okay.
So it's true that the excitatory neurons that respond to the surround have to presumably drive inhibitory neurons. I have always thought of those inhibitory neurons, the inhibitory interneuron, as just inheriting the response properties of the excitatory neuron that's driving. So given that the excitatory neuron shows surround suppression, that inhibitory neuron will show surround suppression also. Very simplified versions of this that I've done, that's the way it's always worked.
Okay, but then what's making them both be suppressed?
So in the feedback version of the feedback divisive gain control models that I've implemented, there's recurrent feedback.
So they're getting more inhibition. That's why they're being suppressed.
The inhibitory neurons have response properties that are identical to the excitatory neurons. They just flip sign. That's all you need to do.
Well, I'm going to show you how that can really work, but I don't understand. I
mean, again, in the simplified kind of signal processing versions of this that I've done, that's simple.
I don't understand. What is driving them down? Why are they both going down? What's the signal that's making them both go down?
So the only problem in terms of implementing it is that the pyramidal cells can't directly inhibit other pyramidal cells. So
yes.
You need an intermediary. Just has to be a copy of the pyramidal cell's response that dumps inhibitory neurotransmitter.
Yes. So everybody is getting. So basically, you're saying the net effect is that when the whole network is active,
the inhibitory neurons' responses look identical to the excitatory neurons' responses, identical.
But that means their firing rate is going down, so everybody's receiving less inhibition than when they started.
No. Like if you increase contrast, all of the neurons increase their responses with contrast.
No, but I'm talking about surround suppression.
Okay. So there's inhibitory neurons. It's the issue of where they are.
If
you're not worried, so the idea is this. So
they could come from somewhere else, and then locally, both E and I go down. But if you recorded intracellularly, you would see that those cells being suppressed were getting more inhibition than before you added the surround stimulus, and that's why they're being suppressed.
Well, no, so I'm being sloppy about where things are in the map.
I don't care where they are. I'm saying if you record intracellularly cell.
So then here's the deal.
Making it suppressed is that it's receiving more inhibition in that picture.
No.
If you know another way to make a neuron fire less, that is alternative to receiving inhibition.
Oh, but all of the neurons end up receiving more inhibition because there's...
That's what I just said. That's the point. They're all receiving more inhibition. If you record intracellularly, when you add the suppressive stimulus, you would see that the inhibition they receive goes up, and that's why their firing rate goes down.
Yes, but the inhibitory neurons' responses don't go up. They go down.
Now, that's all I need. I'm going to show you that that's not true. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. During suppression, both the inhibition and the excitation that cells receive decrease. The suppressive stimulus causes a decrease in the inhibition they receive. So this is the excitatory conductance to the center stimulus or the center plus surround stimulus. Every one of these is one cell. This here identifies the cells. And here's the inhibitory conductance to the center and the center plus surround. And there's basically nothing on it up here. Always less E and less I, or maybe the same, but it's not more. When you're being suppressed. Okay. So let's keep going. Okay. So the interpretation is that during the suppression, both the excitatory and the local inhibitory cells, everyone is suppressed. There isn't any population of inhibitory cells that's firing more and providing inhibition onto the local circuit. And in fact, this has been confirmed directly. Song and Lee showed that they managed to, using cell attached, identify 10 inhibitory neurons, and all of them showed surround suppression just like the excitatory neurons. Okay, so how can addition, so in our picture, this, we're adding external excitation, but we can deal with adding external inhibition. It doesn't really matter. It's all going to have to be the same answer, I'll show you.
Just one question about that previous slide.
Yes.
So was the stimulus always centered on the neuron's receptive field?
Yes. Whoops.
How about if the receptive field of the neuron you're recording from corresponds to the surround?
No. It's centered on the receptive field of the neuron you're recording from. You're recording from one neuron at a time.
I know. Sure. But what about those neurons? I'm wondering about those neurons that are in the...
Okay.
How would the ratio go? If you move this thing around, how would the ratio change?
Yeah.
I could probably make a theoretical prediction if I thought about it, but we don't have any data. Okay. So, how can you add external excitation onto the inhibitory cells? Because presumably that is what's driving the suppression. But I'll deal with inhibition coming in instead in a moment. How can that cause everyone to lower their firing rates? Well, it turns out, and Misha Sodik had showed this in 1997, we didn't know it, so we had to refigure it out. This will happen if excitatory recurrence alone is strong enough that it would be unstable by itself, but the network is stable due to feedback inhibition. So it's dynamically stabilized by the inhibition.
How do you prove the only if direction?
Excuse me?
It's if and only if. How do you prove the only if direction?
I'll show you in a minute.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you see Dave's recent paper on strand suppression?
Yes. Yes.
Can you reconcile that with the other?
Yes. Yeah. Let me get back to that in a minute. Let me present people with the basic idea and then remind me if I forget. Okay. So we'll call this an inhibition stabilized network, or an ISN. And here's in sort of words and pictures how it works, and then I'll show you in null clients how it works. So the idea is just think of a two-population model. You've got your E cells, you've got your I cells. They all talk to themselves and each other. You've got a constitutive center stimulus coming in. So you're at the fixed point for the center stimulus. Now you add the surround stimulus. The center stimulus is still there. I'm just not going to show it. What happens? Well, the inhibitory neuron raises its firing rate, and that causes the excitatory cell to lower its firing rate. And that causes withdrawal of excitation onto the inhibitory cell. So we've added excitation to the inhibitory cell, we've subtracted excitation from the inhibitory cell. Which effect is bigger? Well, it turns out precisely when, if and only if, this guy would be unstable by itself, meaning we're at this fixed point, the center fixed point, and we freeze all the inhibitory rates, we don't allow inhibition to dynamically respond, then the E would be unstable. And precisely in that condition, this is bigger than this. And so what happens now is the I cell is receiving less excitation than when it started, so it lowers its firing rate. And now you're going to say, well, this guy's receiving less inhibition than when it started, so it's going to go up again and everything can oscillate. But no, turns out this is actually the end of the story. And the reason this is the end of the story, the really cool thing, is that what does it mean for this to be unstable by itself? It means that if I were to tick the sitting at the center fixed point, if I were to tick these rates up a little bit, it would recruit so much recurrent excitation that it would want to go up even higher. Similarly, if I tick it down a little bit, it would lose so much recurrent excitation that it would want to collapse to the floor, it would want to go even lower. It loses so much that it can't sustain the lower firing rate. So now what's happened? I've lowered this firing rate by adding inhibition, but that means I've lost so much recurrent excitation that this low firing rate is not stable. It wants to fall to the floor. And so what's going to stabilize it? Well, I better either add some other excitation to this guy, or I better withdraw some inhibition from it. So I withdraw some inhibition from it, boom, I'm at my new stable state, my new steady state, that's the end of the story, no oscillation.
But it means that you have some conditions that come constant for this
inhibition. Your network has to be stable. Has to be, I mean, there's two conditions. The excitatory recurrence alone would be unstable, and the network is stable due to the feedback inhibition. That includes, yeah, or strong enough, or some combination, yeah. I mean, the network isn't unstable. We're not epileptic most of the time.
What's a grayed out connection from surround to the excitatory?
Oh, this is just to mean that we're thinking.
Surround to the excitatory.
Surround. Oh, yeah, we're just, in fact, the surround is not purely hitting these guys, but the hypothesis is that it's more strongly hitting these guys, more weakly hitting those guys, and that's sufficient for this all to work. Okay, so in terms of null clients, let me show you, and this should address if and only if, at least for the 2D model. The inhibitory null client, so this is, sorry, yeah, this is the E cell firing rate, this is the I cell firing rate. Blue is the I cell null client, red is the E cell null client. And the inhibitory null client is always has a positive slope, so it has some shape like this. But the inhibitory null client can have either a positive or a negative slope. And so you might expect generically some shape like this, where when the I cell firing is high, the E cell firing is low, and when the I cell firing is low, the E cell firing is high. So it could go monotonically down, but it could also do this. Well, what it means for the excitatory connections to be unstable by themselves is precisely that the fixed point is where the null client has a positive slope. Because if the null client has a positive slope at the fixed point, then the E derivatives are pointing away from that fixed point. And although the whole network is stable, if you perturb here, you'll do something like that and come back. If you were to freeze the inhibition, then the E alone would be unstable, and it would jump to there or jump to there. To be unstable is to have your fixed point on the positive sloping part of the E null client. And then you can see when you add input to the I cells, that left shifts the I null client. And precisely because this has a positive slope, and also it has a smaller slope than the I null client, which is a necessary condition for stability, then you can see that the fixed point moves down and to the left, meaning both E goes down and I goes down. On the other hand, if it had a positive slope, meaning it was not an inhibition-stabilized network, the excitation was intrinsically stable, it would move up and to the left, meaning the inhibition goes up while the excitation goes down.
Doesn't this require that the inhibition be at least as fast as the excitation?
All it requires is that the network be stable.
Yeah.
And stable.
You work out the stability.
And the stability involves some combination of being fast enough and being strong enough, and you can trade those off to some extent.
And why should the E cell null client look like that? And why is the I cell null client different?
It would be too long a story. We can go through it afterwards. But basically. It's precisely because the excitatory recurrence can be unstable that you have this choice of slopes. The inhibitory.
No, it's not about the local slope. It's about my question, I guess, is why is one of them monotonic and the other one?
Yeah, you just have to go through the math. I don't want to try to do that now. But
well, qubit kind of makes sense. If you think about all excitatory network, it can be either dead quiet or firing like mad.
That's true.
And something in between. So that's basically the way.
Yeah. Okay. That's
Could the competition also occur at an earlier stage, like in the retina?
Yes. So, right. I didn't go into that, but there is some surround suppression coming from through the feedforward inputs. It's weak and it's not. It has little orientation tuning. So the strong orientation tuned suppression. There's a lot of reason, including in our paper, but previous papers, a lot of reason to say that that's coming from within cortex. Yeah, David.
Going back to the book chapter of Ehrman counting rings, the 88, and see, when you have this negative slope, depending on the time scales, this fifth point can often be unstable. In this case, you get some information.
Yes.
Now, I think I agree with David that there are some conditions not about the strength of the coupling, but about the time constant that should be fulfilled in order to get it. As far as I remember, as people here say, the time scale of the inhibition should be much faster.
No, that's not. It's absolutely not required. But can we go through that later? Yeah, but absolutely that's not true. You can just take a linear model and look at the condition for stability. You can have tau I bigger than tau E. It depends. What?
It will depend on the mutual inhibition.
Exactly. It depends on the strength of the inhibition, and it's both the strength and the timing.
The excitability of the. I mean, if you have JII sufficiently large, so then you can reduce these conditions.
If you have JII.
The mutual inhibition can. I mean.
That's right. You need. Yeah. If the EE gets very strong, then you have to have II coupling, or you can't have stability. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
but you do have II coupling, so yeah. Yeah. So there are some stability conditions. Yeah. And I'm assuming the network is stable because, in fact, we have fixed points in response to stimuli. Okay. So. What? What's the problem?
There are two kinds of instabilities here. So the instability you are talking about when you are saying JEE, that the excitatory
population is unstable.
Yes.
So this is rate instability.
Yes.
So that's a condition for getting this this effect, that when you increase the external input, you are reducing both activity. Now, it can be that you have another instability, which is oscillatory instability. And this put a condition on tau I and tau E. Tau I should not be too slow compared to tau E. Now, of course, by playing with other parameters, you can tune this, you know, to have tau I on the same order of tau E. But in principle, tau I cannot be too slow compared to tau E.
Yeah, I agree. It cannot be too slow. Yeah. I agree. Yeah.
Is this a...
Yeah, okay. Okay, so, and now back to David's point, what if it's inhibition coming in from somewhere else? Doesn't matter, because no matter what's going on, the common principle is that when this guy's firing goes down, he loses too much recurrent excitation for that lower firing rate. And so, therefore, he either, no matter what is making him go down, he's either got to receive less inhibition, which is what we see experimentally, or somehow getting another source of external excitation to make up for the deficit. Whereas if he is stable, then as it goes down, it's still got too much recurrence for that lower state, makes it want to go back up, except for the inhibition. So it's got to be receiving more inhibition in order to stably stay at that lower state. So it really doesn't matter what you're bringing in to make things go down. So Andrea asked about, there's a paper from the McCormick lab that looked at responses to natural scenes, and they looked at two sizes of stimuli and reported that the bigger stimuli, so the windows on natural scenes, natural movies actually, and reported that the inhibition was, there was more inhibition for the bigger stimulus when you were looking at natural scenes. What I'm begging and pleading, and Jamie keeps telling me he's going to do it with Jamie, is that he should do the Furster experiment to make sure that they get the same result Furster did, so that this is a difference between paradigms and not between labs. So we don't know that yet. But there's a lot of reasons for this, potentially. And in fact, I have an undergrad student working on that. One is actually just, it's a little funny the way they define things. They define the classical receptive field to be the half max. Usually the classical receptive field is defined to be anywhere you can drive spike responses. They described it as the half max radius. And then they compared that to three times, which is, you know, 1.5. The half max radius is roughly half, maybe 60% of the actual classical receptive field size. So three times is, you know, maybe 50% more than the classical receptive field size. And you get responses going up as well as down. And you could definitely have gone up, even though you're surround suppressed, between half the peak and, you know, 1.5 times the peak. That's one issue. The other issue is that, as we'll see later, whether or not you are in an ISN regime depends on, if we just take a linear model and make it spatial, it's gonna be different for different spatial frequencies. And the drifting grading that David Furster was using, basically a constant input, because to complex cells, to layer 2-3, it's a DC input. Natural scenes have got a lot more high spatial frequency content, even though they're dominated by lower spatial frequencies. And so the high spatial frequencies typically will not be in the ISN regime, even when the low spatial frequencies are. So that could also explain it. And the third thing is that, as you saw from the way I went through it, the inhibition transiently goes up, but in the steady state goes down. So linearly, you know, if you have a linear model, then for any stimulus, you know, if you're showing stimuli that if you're evoking ISN-like reactions, your mean inhibition is going to go down. However, with nonlinearities, it could very well be that these transients are emphasized relative to the sustained mean. So all of these are possibilities. I don't know the answer though.
How can you ignore this surround input possibly exciting the E cells as well?
It just has to be weak enough, and then this all works.
It has to be weaker.
It turns out, actually, I spent a long time in this in the Ozeki et al. 2009 paper. There's a scenario where you could try to explain all of this by, you notice that I said that you know, has to receive less inhibition or more external excitation. Well, what if it's getting more external excitation from the surround and that's making the difference? And it turns out, but I don't want to, you can rule that out because it leads to some predictions which are the opposite of the data. But it's a longer argument that I want to get into here. Okay, so the predictions of the ISN model, you should see a transient increase in inhibition at the onset of the surround before the steady state decrease. And David spent, after we first just thought this is so cool, we're going to try to submit it, and the referee said, well, we'd like to see that transient increase. So David spent about a year. It was a really hard experiment, but he saw it. I'm not going to show you the data because I don't want to get bogged down here. Second, that cells that aren't receiving much recurrent excitation, that most of their excitation is from the LDN, they shouldn't show much surround suppression because the suppression is not an inhibition. It's a withdrawal of recurrent excitation. If you're not getting much, you can't be suppressed. And it turned out in a complicated way it was possible to test that, and both of these were verified. And I should say that this first point is sort of the killer point that rules out almost any other scenario you can think of. Any other way you're going to do this, you're not going to get the going up before the going down. Okay, so conclusion, surround suppression appears to be not inhibition but deamplification. Responses are normally being amplified by recurrent excitation, and I'm going to talk more about this amplification, balanced amplification. The surround stimulus adds a bias toward the inhibition, and that pulls down both the E and the I, lowers the amplification of the whole network, and that's what surround suppression is. Okay, so let me talk a little bit more about this amplification. Oh boy, I've got a speed. You all heard Saria talk about non-normality. How late do I go? What's my...
12:30.
That's an hour. Well, that's when they're leaving. He told me he was leaving then. Well, anyhow, let me try to get through. So the main thing is that, just to repeat about non-normality, because you have separate excitatory and inhibitory neurons, your connection matrix looks like this. You've got positive columns corresponding to the output of the E cells and negative columns corresponding to the output of the I cells. That's a very non-normal matrix. It doesn't commute with its transpose. And that means that the eigenvectors are not orthogonal. And then, as Tria talked about, all kinds of funny things happen. And you can get a new kind of amplification. And we talk about this in, I don't know if I mentioned the pattern. Somehow I lost the reference, but there's a paper, Murphy and Miller, 2009, that talks about this whole issue. And the basic intuition, you know what? I'm gonna forget the intuition. It's cool, but let's try to keep going.
But hadn't made that picture actually.
Yeah, he also didn't show it.
He skipped everything.
Yeah. When you have non-orthogonal eigenvectors. Well, you know what? Actually, I should do. Okay. So here's the idea. These are my two non-orthogonal eigenvectors for my 2D system.
Can you actually go back one more slide for about 15 seconds so I can just see the system?
I haven't even told you. I mean, I just.
Yeah. No. I'm happy now. You can go.
Okay. Okay. So here's my two eigenvectors, and now I want to represent this initial condition. And this is sort of poorly represented by those eigenvectors, and that's where all the mischief arises. So how do I represent this? Well, I've got to have a big component, positive component of this one, and a big negative component of this one, and those two have to cancel to make something small. Whenever you have two big things canceling to make something small, you know a lot of mischief can happen. You've lost Pythagoras' theorem. You know, the sum of the squares of the components is much bigger than the thing, than the vector. So it's a stable system. Both eigenvalues have negative real parts. So both eigenvalues decay, but they decay at different rates. And so what happens is the one on the bottom decays faster. And so you had two big things that were conspiring to create something small. One of them goes away, and the other big thing is revealed. And so you get then the trajectory looks like this. The response. The overall size of the response increases transiently, even though as t goes to infinity, the system's stable, and you have to go back to the fixed point. David? No? Okay. So in reality, our network was having more activity before it went back to having less activity. But if you were in the eigenvector basis, you wouldn't see that. You'd think that everything is monotonically decaying. That's because when the eigenvector is not orthogonal, that's a non-unitary transformation. It does a huge warping of space. And so we don't want to do that. So what's the best you can do? How much can you simplify a matrix with a unitary transformation so that you're just rotating, you're not distorting space? The answer is the Schur decomposition, which is found by starting with the eigenvectors and then doing a Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization of the eigenvectors. And in this basis, in many bases, there's many Schur bases, they're not unique. The eigenvalues are on the diagonal, and the upper diagonal is non-zero. We think of these as the feed-forward weights. The lower diagonal is zero. So we think of these as the feed-forward weights because they represent exclusively feed-forward chain of connectivity between the activity patterns, the orthogonal set of activity patterns that form the Schur basis. So the picture is, the eigenvector picture is that you've got, for linear dynamics, is that you've got a bunch of independent patterns, each of which is exciting or inhibiting itself according to its eigenvalue, and they each go about their merry way ignoring the others. Well, that's true, but they're not really ignoring each other because although their dynamics ignore each other, they're conspiring together to add up to the vector because they're not orthogonal. So there's this hidden dependence where one goes away, the other one is revealed. And so to get around that, you'd like to go to the Schur basis. And what that does is it makes the dependence explicit. You have a different set of patterns. So this one has changed. This one is still the same because you start with one eigenvector that remains invariant, and then you do Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization. So now each pattern is exciting or inhibiting itself according to an eigenvalue. But in addition, there's a feed-forward connection from this guy to that guy. And what that essentially represents is in this picture, it's the fact that a little perturbation in this direction led to a big response in that direction. Now you've got an orthogonal basis, a little perturbation in this direction drives a feed-forward connection onto this direction. And so now it's explicit in the feed-forward connections.
But it's only a 2x2 matrix, right?
No, this is true in general, any matrix.
However, you're only looking at excitation between the inhibitor and the excitator, right?
Well, actually, in the paper here, we also built a big network, and even big spiking network, and showed that in a big spiking network, it all works. So there are lots and lots of cells and lots of modes, and you can look into what goes on in that. But it's all the same picture, that there's this hidden feed-forward connectivity where a little bit of input into one direction, like this direction, causes a big response in a poorly represented direction, leads to a big response in a well-represented direction, and that's what's embodied in the feed-forward weights.
WFF has to be positive?
No, but if it's big, then you're going to get big things out of small things. And it will be positive in many cases. So in particular, so Saria talked about long feed-forward chains, which gives him interesting temporal properties. We're thinking more about the separation between E and I cells as driving the non-normality. And in particular, if you think about having translation invariant connectivity, then in a linear model, everything separates in Fourier space, so you end up with a 2x2 matrix, two population model for each frequency. And so since you have all these independent two population models, the links can only be one length long. They're always within the same frequency. So you only get single links, and instead of getting long temporal scales from long chains, what you can get instead is big amplification without much even speeding up. In fact, it turns out that you can have a amplified response which is faster than you would have if there were no your response would be if there were no recurrence, against our intuition that the recurrent part always comes in more slowly than the feed forward part. Okay, and then if you want to think about a balanced network as one that where patterns can neither excite nor inhibit themselves so that all the eigenvalues are small because excitation and inhibition are balanced. It's kind of a stringent definition that all of the modes should be balanced. But if you want to think of it that way, then the Schur picture is basically a feed-forward network because the eigenvalues become negligibly small. Okay, So what does it have to do with surround suppression? Well, let's take a simple example of this, and we did a lot more in the paper, but I'm not going to go there. But just have, for simplicity, we assume that the two projections of the E cell are the same size and the two projections of the I cell are the same size. That makes everything simple. So here's our equations. And we transform to sum and difference variables, RE plus RI and RE minus RI. And what you see then is the difference variable just decays independently, but the sum variable, well, it both has an eigenvalue, which if the inhibition is stronger than the excitation is negative eigenvalue, but it's also getting now feed-forward input from the difference. And whereas this becomes negative if, it's minus W plus. So whereas this minus W plus becomes negative if the inhibition is big, the inhibition is big, just builds a big feedforward weight, comes in with a positive sign. And so the picture then is that this, you know, fully recurrently connected matrix or circuit is really a feedforward circuit plus some self-inhibition, which speeds up and suppresses this guy's response. And so how does this relate to surround suppression? Well, what this is saying is that small differences between, so we have our E and our I, and if the weights are strong, if W is strong, then both, then these things are big. If the weights are strong, then you know, you have this balanced network, strong excitation, strong inhibition. If you disturb the balance a little bit, you drive E up a little bit, then E wants to take off, because it's maybe unstable by itself, but it pulls up I with it, so it drives up the sum. If you give some input to I, then E wants to come down, but it pushes down the sum, so the I goes down with it. And so what's happening in when we give the input to I in the surround suppression case, an input to I is a combination of a negative input here and a positive input here. And so first of all, there's direct effects. A negative input here drives this down, which means inhibition is going up. A positive input here drives this up, which means inhibition is going up. So the direct effects of adding input to inhibition are that the inhibition firing rate raises, which is your usual intuition. It's not the paradoxical effect that it ends up going down when you try to add input to it. The paradoxical effect is from this feed-forward weight. When this guy goes down, and if this feed-forward weight is big, then this guy goes down a lot, more than the direct drive to make it go up. So it's a competition between the non-normal, or the feed-forward weight, which is causing the I to go down, and the sort of normal effects, which are causing the I to go up. And this effect is bigger than those effects precisely when the E alone is unstable. So what surround suppression is just a, you know, turning down this balanced amplification, turning this guy down, and therefore turning that guy down.
Again, it would be the off-diagonal terms which would make the eigenvectors close to each other, right?
In the Schur basis, yes, yes. The fact that you have off-diagonal terms in the Schur basis is what makes them close to each other.
In your model, you're trying to have the effect of the inhibition on the excitatory and the inhibitory very different. So you're trying to have exactly these.
No. We have. This is the circuit. It's just, you know.
Well, it's the center. You're right.
Yeah.
It's the center.
Yeah.